Now, our weekly rendezvous with an ambitious lady. She's Jill Bevilacqua, and I might say she thinks in centuries, at least Vatican centuries, having written and presented a 45-part series which takes us on a journey back in time to rediscover the lives and legends of the people and places that went into the making of the Vatican. Now, if you've been following this series produced by Sean Patrick Lovett, you'll know that in Chapter 20, by the title of Splendour and Decline, we heard about papal coronations in the Middle Ages, how Boniface VIII announced a jubilee year, and how St. Thomas Aquinas summarised Christian doctrine. Today, in Episode 21, which Jill has called The Long Absence, we hear how the popes move to Avignon, how the Black Death rages in Rome, and on a more arty note, how Giotto decorates St. Peter's. And the poet Petrarch appeals to the Pope to return home.
Chapter 21, The Long Absence.
By the beginning of the 14th century, the medieval world was beginning to fall apart.
Gone was the certainty of its religious vision, with spiritual and political order founded on the dual authority of Pope and Emperor. With the gradual decadence of the feudal and hierarchical institutions, a new sense of nationalism was emerging.
It is a period of sharp contrasts. In Europe, there was great social stress. Italy was torn by political turmoil.
England and France, constantly fighting, now became involved in the Hundred Years' War. And from Eastern Asia came disease, the Black Death, sweeping across the continent, and in a space of 20 years reducing its total population by a third. It claimed over 60 million victims.
For the Church, too, it was a troubled time. There was a diminishing of authority due to the transfer of the papal court to Avignon. This period of exile, which lasted nearly 70 years, was known as the Babylonian Captivity, recalling the imprisonment of the Israelites in Babylon.
But it was an epoch which saw a great flowering of mystics and contemplatives. Catherine of Siena, Julian of Norwich, John of Raisbrook, and Richard Roll. The Italian sculptor Pisano was working in bronze and marble. Froissart was writing his Chronicles of Western Europe, Boccaccio his Decameron, while on the capital, the poet and scholar Petrarch was crowned with laurel.
Although the official seat of papal government had always been Rome, since 1100 the popes had only actually resided in the city for 82 years, but they'd never lived outside Italy.
Now, in 1308, the newly elected French pope, Clement V, announced officially that the papal curia was to remove to Avignon in the south of France. Six more French popes followed, but the papal court remained captive, for the French kings wished to keep the popes under their influence, and many of the French cardinals disliked living in Italy. Then Benedict XII, 1334 to 1342, began the building of the great papal palace in Avignon. It seemed that the popes were lost to Rome.
Conditions in the Eternal City were desperate. There was no effective government, and the people, with no law to protect them, defended themselves as best they could. Delinquency was rampant and human life held lightly. Money was stolen, cattle abducted, houses burnt down, women raped, convents raided. Every morning, corpses were swept from the streets and thrown into the Tiber with the refuse.
The buildings, too, were in a sorry state. Many of the churches and papal palaces were in various stages of decay, damaged by fire, old age, weather, and the repeated sackings and pilferings of stonework, statuary, and tiles. The Milvian Bridge had been razed to the ground by the Orsini family, who owned the only other bridge near Castel Sant'Angelo. The belfry of St. Peter's had been destroyed by lightning. And on May 6, 1308, the Church of St. John Lateran caught fire and was seriously damaged. Columns, monuments, and the roof were devastated. It seemed like a divine punishment for the abandonment of the city by its bishop.
The people were desolate. They walked the streets in procession, dolefully chanting psalms, until they reached the smoking basilica. Then they set to work clearing the debris. Offerings poured in for the reconstruction, and Clement V ordered that it be undertaken immediately. But in 1360, fire broke out again, and this time Giotto's fresco of the Jubilee of 1300 was almost totally destroyed.
The pilgrims who came to Rome for the Jubilee of 1350 saw a very different picture from their predecessors. To the absence of the Pope was added the ruinous aspect of the city, which only a year or so before had been shaken by earthquake. On that occasion, the Church of the Twelve Apostles crumbled to dust, St. Paul's was badly damaged, and the facade of the Lateran Basilica collapsed.
Although there are no written records of the Black Death in Rome, an eloquent memorial still exists in the marble staircase leading up to the Church of Arcelli on the Capitoline Hill. In that church was an image of the Virgin, to which the Romans attributed the ending of the epidemic, and in 1348 they built the staircase as a thank offering.
Probably the last artistic work of any importance to be done in Old St. Peter's was that performed by Giotto at the turn of the century. He was commissioned by the Pope to depict five scenes from the life of Christ for the high altar.
The Pope rewarded him with 600 gold ducats and was so pleased with his style that he ordered the artist to decorate the interior with scenes from the Old and New Testaments. Much of Giotto's work was lost when the old basilica was demolished, but some pieces were saved and transferred to the new building.
The best-known piece of work, which can still be seen today, is the Navicella mosaic, representing the bark of St. Peter's tossed on the waves. The work was said to have cost over 2,000 florins.
If we look up above the central portal of St. Peter's before entering the church, we can still see the relic of the Navicella, scarcely distinguishable among the shadows. One can pick out Christ walking on the waters, and below him, almost invisible, the donor, Cardinal Stefaneschi, nephew of Boniface VIII, who gave the mosaic to old St. Peter's in 1298.
Legend has it that Giotto was discovered at the age of 10 by the painter Cimabue, making drawings of his father's sheep on stones. Cimabue took him to Florence to teach him art, and Giotto was soon drawing so accurately from life that he made a definite break with the crude Byzantine style. The technique of life drawing had been neglected for some 200 years. Now Giotto restored it, and by representing nature closely and using a greater lightness of colouring than his master, he brought the art of painting to life.
There's a story that when Giotto was still a young man in Cimabue's workshop, he painted a fly on one of the master's figures. It was so lifelike that when Cimabue returned, he tried several times to brush it off with his hand till he realised his mistake.
Giotto began by working on mosaic and ended in architecture. But his most important work was as a muralist, and his frescoes in the Avena Chapel in Padua are considered the greatest of his surviving works, while the best known are probably the Assisi frescoes, still admired by thousands of pilgrims each year. In 1334, Giotto was made chief architect of Florence Cathedral, and the Campanile, known as Giotto's Tower, was his masterpiece of design.
Time passed, and gradually the papacy regained control in Italy, so that the popes were able to consider returning to Rome.
In 1362, a Benedictine was elected, who took the name of Urban V. The poet Petrarch saw in this choice of name a whole programme, for the name Urban was taken from Urbe, or city. The new pope also had been apostolic delegate in Naples and knew the country.
Petrarch decided to appeal to the new pontiff to bring the papal court back to Rome.
In the absence of the legitimate husband, there is no more peace. Wars follow ceaselessly on each other. The houses totter. The temples and walls are crumbling. Civil life no longer flourishes behind the protective shield of the law. How then can the Pope have the courage to fall asleep beneath the gilded ceilings of the Palace of Avignon? And how can the cardinals seat themselves calmly on gold and ivory stools when the Lateran, mother of all the churches, is roofless, open to the fury of wind and rain, when the holy houses of Peter and Paul are on the verge of collapse, when what was once the dwelling of the apostles is nothing but an amorphous mass of stones which would touch even the hardest heart? A city in ruins, but nevertheless, a sacred city.
And heartfelt thanks there go to Jill Bevilacqua for yet another episode of the Vatican Centuries in this series produced by Sean Patrick Lovett, whom we thank as well. Be sure to tune in at the same time next week for episode 22, when we'll already have reached the 14th century and two women pressure Pope Gregory XII to return home and set up papal residence in the Vatican. Well, thanks for listening. I'm Veronica Scaresbrick.